you very much, Alan. Our final presenter for this session is Bruce Lever from the Parks Division of the Department of Environment and Heritage. Bruce.
Thank you. I want to build on a comment made by Jerry Williams. He posed the question, can we deal with the differences that divide us? So I want to look at the social aspects of fire. The embers of a big fire will not even cool before the debate erupts. This invariably focuses on locked-up firebomb national parks being a danger to life and limb, and subsequent media comment and formal inquiries, and I might say decade after decade, opens up a depressingly familiar Pandora's box of community anger, resentment and blame hunting, often focused on perceptions of crazy greenies overriding what is regarded as sensible approaches. This last fire season even saw National Park Management actually blamed in the media for major fires and asset losses in state forests when actually no national park area was involved. And as the big fire scenario is likely to worsen, it may be useful to ponder the bushfire social and cultural environment. Now, what in the hell's going on here? The fire map from the latest El Nino drought for southeastern Australia is almost the same as the 1939 fire map from an era not only was extensive grazing and burning, but long before national parks. Now, national parks as a form of land use is a fairly late arrival on the Australian scene. The first great land allocations were mainly relating to farming and then to pastoralism in the 19th century, and suitable land was quickly set aside for those purposes. The second great wave was the state forests in the early part of the 20th century. Parks didn't really take hold until the 1960s and the 70s and 80s saw a lot of the park areas established. Now, most national parks, as a consequence of that, are the areas of land that are left over. Cynically, a national park is defined as an area of land that nobody else wants. The majority of Australia's parks were former Crown lands or Crown leases, and often they are the remote, rugged, unclearable or unloggable areas, highly prone to lightning strike, and thus opening the seeds of resentment that were sown with their establishment as national park. This was often added to because limited access to those areas was then denied, as leases were often used for grazing, and other forms of recreation by local communities was no longer allowed. So the impositions of those sort of controls introduced a degree of resentment that in many areas is there today. The second class of national parks related to those areas established after vigorous and public campaigns. This mainly included forestry areas, including rainforests and areas planned for woodchip operations and plantation establishment. The campaigns were often urban-based, and subsequent loss of areas and means of employment stimulated extreme levels of resentment and bitterness that continues to this day. The salt in the wound was often the trivialising and ridiculing of local heritage and traditions by those in the debate. Now, the third class of national park are those that are purchased on the open market. Now, vendors are often willing partners in that transaction, but that enthusiasm is really matched in the surrounding rural community. And this is often associated not only with the loss of a family, but also loss of health, consequent health and education services, and the loss of rate revenue to local government. So with this rich history of alienation, it's almost guaranteed that a big fire will stimulate a robust adverse social response as the smoke column rises in the sky. To the above potent brew, the Uniform Ranger was added. The New South Wales Coalition Government in 1967 established the first state park service based on the US Park Service model, which in itself was modelled on the US frontier military. The first New South Wales director, in fact, was seconded from the US Park Service and introduced the notion of the Uniform Ranger, and sooner or later, all states in the Commonwealth had uniform rangers in the landscape. Needless to say, in the Australian cultural environment, that was pretty well resented. National parks are probably here to stay. 58 million hectares are in the protected area system. These attract some 20 million visitors per year, which is not bad for a locked-up system. Increasingly, these areas are a major asset to Australia's tourism economy, and a very significant foreign exchange earner, indeed in some areas, is the most important part of a regional economy. In fact, employment in some areas can be as high as 50%. My experience is that when local parks, like local state forests, become a mainstay of a regional economy, the levels of resentment and bitterness ease. It's hard to maintain the rage when your kids are employed in the business. The social and cultural elements of big fires and national parks is well worth frank discussion. We've heard it here today many, many times, many of the issues I talked about. Big fires will mean big debates and big inquiries and garages full of Volvos for lawyers. Park managers tend to plunge into the fray, arguing the botany and the physics of the fire, but they rarely understand the cultural and heritage dimensions that are often underpinning the community angst. Despite all the clatter, defensible fire management will be based on clear objectives, understanding the botany, which of course is the fuel engine, and the application of fire physics. End of story, end of debate. However, getting the science right does not necessarily mean you will get the cultural engagement right. This may take a lot more sensitivity and work than has applied in the past. And finishing with Jerry Williams, he commended the trend in social research in fire. I agree. Thank you.